Hello, and welcome to Rare Cuts Media Society. I'm Andrew Jagoda, and with me today, as always, are our other hosts, Mike Ross. How are you today, Mike?
So far, so good.
Good to hear. And we've got Rob Lachick. How are you today, Rob?
Oh, doing pretty good. Ready to talk about some Disney movies.
All right, me too. And then, of course, we've got Eric Hathorne. Eric, how are you?
I'm doing great because I did finally do the thing that I probably should have done since the beginning and picked a Disney thing. And Rob did just say that he was going to talk about Disney movies, plural. So I'm going to hold him to that. There better be talk about multiple Disney movies, not just the one that I picked.
Let's re-record this nonsense now.
Nope. It's on the recording.
All right. And yeah, we'll stick with you then, Eric, so you can introduce the history segment here today.
Awesome sauce. So I picked The North Avenue Irregulars, which is a Disney movie from 1979, which is kind of an awkward period for Disney. I think I said at the end of last month's episode, I before this had not seen it, but was always kind of intrigued at to how like at what it was like. So I was excited to get in here with fresh eyes and take a look at it with a somewhat outsider's perspective. So I'm going to get on into some of the history of this movie. Reverend Albert Fay Hill was a paratrooper, a civil rights advocate, and a cancer researcher who championed the use of vaccines. He also worked with the FBI and the Department of the Treasury to take on organized crime. In 1961, Reverend Hill was made the senior pastor of the North Avenue Presbyterian Church in New Rochelle, New York. While Hill was pastor, a young man in New Rochelle was murdered over gambling debts to an underground mafia-run gambling ring. Organized crime was rampant in the New Rochelle community, and Hill took notice and decided to use his platform as pastor to take on the mob. He successfully hindered mob activity using a neighborhood watch-style organization made up of members of his church community and caught the eye of the FBI, who had been trying to infiltrate this gambling ring but hadn't been successful. Government officials teamed up with the members of the North Avenue Presbyterian Church and were able to squash organized crime from New Rochelle. In 1968, Reverend Hill wrote a book about his crime-busting experience, and he titled it The North Avenue Irregulars, A Suburb Battles the Mafia. This was a reference to the Baker Street Irregulars, a ragtag group of boys who work as spies for Sherlock Holmes. The very next year, Disney acquired the rights to Hill's book. In the late 1960s, Walt Disney Productions was operating without its leader. In 1966, Walt Disney had passed away with many unfinished projects still on the table. Now helmed by Walt's older brother, Roy, the company continued carrying out what Walt had already started, but there was a big question mark on how the company would continue after those projects were completed. Throughout the rest of the 1960s and into the 1970s, the memory of Walt Disney continued to shape what movies were made. The studio heads often asked themselves, what would Walt do? And one thing Walt did do well was transform great books and stories into movies that the whole family could enjoy. The company had acquired the rights to the North Avenue Irregulars in 1968, but hadn't started developing the movie until a decade later. In 1977, Walt's son-in-law turned studio exec Ron Miller greenlit the North Avenue Irregulars and served as its executive producer. The story was adapted for the screen by veteran Disney live-action screenwriter Don Tate, and Bruce Bilson, known more for his work on TV, directed. The movie follows Reverend Michael Hill, played by Edward Herman, as he takes on the job of pastor at North Avenue Presbyterian Church in fictitious New Campton, California. The church has fallen on hard times, and Hill's job is to turn this around, which is made even more difficult when one of the church's members gambles away the last of North Avenue's funds in an illegal gambling ring. Hill now is faced with taking on the mob to save the church from closure and restore their funds. The North Avenue Irregulars has a large cast consisting of many recognizable faces. Comedy legend Cloris Leachman is a member of the crime-busting church congregation, along with Virginia Capers, Karen Valentine, Barbara Harris, Patsy Kelly in her final film role. Alan Hale Jr. plays Harry the Hat, a gangster, working for the mob boss played by Frank Campanella. And Michael Constantine plays a U.S. government agent. Among many other actors recognizable from other movies and TV shows. The movie was produced on the Disney Studios lot in Burbank and many locations across Los Angeles. 14 brand new automobiles were destroyed during the filming of this movie, racking up a bill of over $150,000 just for cars. Even though a lot of cars, money, and B-list celebrities were used in the production of the North Avenue Irregulars, it has mostly fallen into obscurity. Since its theatrical release in 1979, Disney has put it on VHS and DVD, but it has not, as of yet, made its way to Disney Plus for streaming. So the North Avenue Irregulars does actually have a pretty robust history. It's based on a true story. That's kind of a weird thing, especially now having watched the movie. And that's something I really wasn't expecting until I did the research. So that was kind of neat. More on that later, of course. What I do want to ask you guys first is I want to ask this question. This is not this. Let's be clear. I don't want to ask, did you like the movie yet? I don't want that question to come out yet. I'm sure that'll come out in your answers. But I want to ask this. I want to ask, what did you expect from this movie when you started watching it? And did it fall below, at, or above your expectations? So you're just ranking it to what your expectations were. And of course, you know, tell us a little bit how you got there.
All right. So what did I expect before? So I read the back of the DVD case, and it talked about church members fighting the mob. So I was like, okay, all right. It sounds kind of goofy, but I'm in. So I turned it on, and then I just get the cartoon intro with like the Pink Panther type of music. I was like, all right, yeah, I don't know about this one.
Really? At the animated intro, that's when you...
Well, because I was like, wait a second, I was expecting something maybe a little bit more like, I mean, to no, hopefully no spoiler alert here. The church gets firebombed or bombed. Like I expected more like that throughout the movie, but it just was ended up being much far sillier.
He brought up the animated intro that made me think of you, Mike. What were your expectations? And then, of course, tell us about your feelings on the animated intro. But what were your expectations before you watched it? And then also.
Yeah, I mean, I knew that there must be something a bit off with this movie for the fact that it's not on Disney Plus. when they have so much on Disney Plus. It to me, that was a red flag already. And then I read the summary, I watched the trailer, and I was thinking it'd be like a sort of goofy comedy. I was actually happy when I saw the animated intro. It kind of reminded me a little bit of like the Rocky and Bullwinkle style. And you know, I'm a sucker for animated beginnings like National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. I love that intro. It makes the movie so much more inviting. And so, but the intro went on for a while, and it was just kind of like a tit for tat, like back and forth, like, oh, the women are chasing the burglar. Oh, they're getting the money from the burglar. Now the burglars are getting the money back. And so to me, it was almost like, are they showing me the movie? And to a certain extent, they kind of are. But so my expectations were pretty low. and then my hope went up with the animated intro. And then at the end of the animated intro, my hope started to die.
All right. So of course this is just expectations here. So Andrew, we're on to you now here. We've got your expectations before watching, expectations after. Tell us a little bit.
So my expectations going in were pretty much it's probably kind of a middle of the road movie. It's Disney, it's supposed to be a comedy, but it's done back in the late 70s. And honestly, it met my expectations exactly. I was like, you know, this isn't a great movie, but it's something that the family would have enjoyed in the late 70s. And going off of what Mike was talking about with the animated intro, it really gave me like that Disney feeling from when I was a kid watching the intro to Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Oh yeah, there's another good one.
Another Disney connection there.
But
it did go on forever. It seemed like they had a cast list and they just said, oh, he plays cop number 4. Okay, we're going to put him in the opening credits. And it just was like, oh my gosh, how many screens of names can they have for a movie? At least my, I rented it when I watched it off of Vudu, I think.
Nice.
And so when it ended, it had no end credits. And I said to myself, well, it didn't need end credits because it put everyone before the movie.
For real.
Yeah.
It does. It does kind of do that. It skips out on end credits. It's just like the end and it's done. But it does have a very long sequence. And there are a lot of people in it for sure. Mm-hmm. And they do kind of name everybody in it. So, yeah, it is a long intro segment. But I'm really glad you said that you thought it was going to be a middle of the road. Not that any of anyone's expectation things were right or wrong answers. But Andrew got the right answer as far as I'm concerned. No.
Wow.
No offense, Mike and Rob. But no.
Rob, let's go watch a movie about cobras.
Yes.
I will be keeping score for this whole... No, just kidding. But no, Disney was... That's kind of like what they specialize in, is that kind of middle of the road family movie. Like everyone... Like they're good compromise movies. Sometimes, like in the case of like Mary Poppins, it's like a great thing that the whole family can enjoy to a really full extent. But at the end of the day, they would make those movies, those family movies that everyone would. It's kind of like everyone will be satisfied with what they saw by the end of it. So they're shooting for that, you know, kind of middle of the road movie for the whole family. And I think what happened, kind of like when I was talking about it at the beginning, after Walt passed away, it kind of got watered down. Over the years, they kept making the kind of like, let's follow his kind of pattern that he would set up for these movies. But it would kind of get watered down over time. And this, I think, is a very good example of it being pretty darn watered down. I'm kind of with you there, Andrew. I thought it would be middle of the road. And I was satisfied with what I got personally. It's not in my, we'll save our feelings about it for later on towards the end. All right. Another thing Andrew noticed, 10 points for Andrew, just kidding, is that he mentioned all the people in it, and it does have a large cast of, like, should I say B-list, C-list, D-list? How far down can I go in the letters?
But Z.
There's a lot, right? All the way down to Z-list actors. It's got a large cast of all of that, you know, like those lesser known people, a lot of like TV stars, people who would maybe make more appearances on TV. Were there any celebrities that you guys had that you were like, oh, hey, that's the guy from, or she's from, or
the
I remember
Skipper.
There you go. Mike, tell us about it.
Oh man. Once I saw Skipper on there, I got excited. And he is easily the most recognizable person aside from Cloris Leachman in the film. this was after Gilligan's Island, and you know, I saw him and I thought he was going to be like a major character in the film, but he's only in it for a couple minutes and then he disappears. And again, disappointment might have been growing. I'm not saying if I liked it or not.
You're not. Thank you. No. So yeah, the Harry the Hat is the skipper from Gilligan's Island. I was really hoping they would put a skipper hat on him. He's Harry the Hat. You give him a skipper hat and that would be a nice little fan service nod kind of thing. But I guess we do that more in movies now, not so much in 1979.
I will say with him though, I don't know if it's just because of, you know, age or if he was having health problems at the time or anything. But to me, I was like, that's the skipper, but why does he look so bad?
Because he's in color.
And I, because I, to me, it was like he always was a very powerful presence in Gilligan's Island. And then on there, he seemed kind of like, you know, just hunched over and out of place almost. So I would have thought that he would have fit better if, as the Harry the Hat crime boss kind of guy, if he'd been back to his old stature, you know, standing tall and everything. But maybe he was having health issues or age problems. I don't know.
Definitely later in his career than Gilligan's Island.
Mm-hmm.
There was one character who I recognized from one of my favorite TV shows.
Go for it.
Douglas Fowley, who played Delaney, he also appeared at least in one. He probably appeared in more than one, but in one episode of the Andy Griffith Show, he appears as a bum who befriends the kids of Mayberry, and that Andy ultimately runs out of town on a rail at the end of the episode. But when I saw him, I'm like, wait a second, where's that? Where have I seen that guy from? And then I finally remembered that he was the do nothing bum that Andy rode out of town in the Andy Griffith Show.
And you know, he actually had, if you look him up, he had a huge list of acting credits.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, through the 30s, 40s, 50s, it was just like, holy cow, he did a lot. Nothing that I could say on a podcast, you know, go watch this because it's amazing, because I have no idea.
Go watch the Andy Griffith Show.
But yeah, go watch the Andy Griffith Show. Yeah. And for me, I had two that stood out. One was Susan Clark, the secretary for the church. I kept banging my head on the wall saying, where do I know her from? Where do I know her from? And she was the mom on Webster.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
So I had to look that up because I could not immediately place her. But then the big one for me was I loved seeing Michael Constantine, the Treasury Department guy. He was funny in this movie and I just loved him as an actor. He passed away unfortunately last year, but he was great as his name was Marv Fogelman, and you know, the way that he acted like he was going to have a coronary every time that they screwed up in this.
Yes. Yeah, I always remember Michael Constantine from My Big Fat Greek Wedding, putting a little Windex on everything. That's my frame of reference for him, of course. And I gotta give a couple of other shout outs to some of my favored actors here. So one of them too, I like knew going into it, Edward Herman, Richard Gilmore. I think I may have pitched it to you guys, or I know I at least pitched it to Carrie, my wife. I was like, this movie, like when I was like, everyone want to watch this with me. This movie has, you know, Richard Gilmore as a Presbyterian minister. And then like people stopped listening to me and no one watched it with me. But but I had her at for a minute at you know, Richard Gilmore, because we love that show. But he was a big one. And then as I was watching it, I recognized Virginia Capers. I couldn't tell you her name. I couldn't tell you where I had seen her before, but it was like, something's bothering me. I just saw this lady in something and I don't know where she's from. And I had to go look it up. And I found that she was Uncle Phil's mom in Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, which we had just rewatched with the kids like a month ago. So she popped up and I was like,
oh, prior to the slap. That,
I know her. And then, right. Well, yeah, that's, I mean, yeah. We've got her in there from Fresh Prince. I recognized her and she had been recently on my mind. So I think we hit a bunch of them, and there's still a bunch of names on the cast list that I'm sure we could go and deep dive forever and find out the little, you know, TV spots they've been at, mostly TV things. I feel like they've pop up in TV a lot and not a lot in movies. But let's go into from the actor side to the character side. Of course, since there is a big cast, there's a lot of different characters popping up all over the whole movie. Did anyone have a favorite standout character, not necessarily actor, but character?
Mr. and Mrs. Rafferty.
Yes.
Quite a comedic duo.
Yes.
Yep.
They were by far my favorite too of the movie as well.
So both of you, tell us why the Rafferties.
I think they're the most genuinely funny.
Yes. Like, I don't know if it was like part of her character, but like Patsy Kelly playing Rose, like, I don't know if she was like pretending to be drunk or if she was drunk, or because it was like she was like unaware where she was or like had these weird facial expressions. But yeah, I agree. I think they were just like the naturally like funny through the entire movie. I mean, just for being goofy, but yeah, they were by far my two favorite.
I mean, they're the catalyst for the whole movie. I mean, without them, had the Reverend not handed over all the finances to Mrs. Rafferty, wouldn't have happened. This whole film would have been done.
So we can go into this later, but that's a huge plot hole. How do they never go back to Delaney and be like, what's wrong with you, you big idiot? Why do you spend the money at one bet?
We can talk about that right now. Let's talk about that right now.
It's the only way to raise the funds, lad. You have some of that sacramental wine.
He does. Well, like how I, yeah, he does put it all on, he puts it all on one horse. And you're right. He's never actually held accountable for it.
No. So basically this movie basically encourages people to lose all their money gambling for a horse.
Plus the church's money.
Plus the church's money on top of
Well, I guess maybe it encourages you to lose someone else's money, like a church or a business, instead of your own, you know. And as you're talking about them, too, you're saying, like, that's true. They are the catalyst for this whole movie actually happening. And actually, from, like, the minute the non-animated part starts of the movie, they're involved in the most like action and craziness with the whole thing, you know, that how he's introduced and whatnot. So they are kind of like that thing running through the whole movie that kind of keeps it. They are the plot.
They are the glue of the plot. Let's say
they are the glue of the plot. There you go.
And Mr. like Rafferty was the seventh woman, and he is the one that wanted that title.
And he ruined his hose.
He does. He got a run in him. He did get
You could have had just like the whole movie just be these two that are trying to foil the mob and get their money back.
Now, see, that would be a movie that I would embrace wholeheartedly.
Nice.
See, I have to go a little different tack. I mean,
go for it.
For me, I liked Cleo Jackson, or as her radio name was Clunker, because she had to me the most like close idea to how to follow cars for as like a spy, because of her husband having the used car lot. She kept switching cars, and I thought that was hilarious, and that each one had like a different thing on the window, like, you know, one owner and, you know, barely driven or whatever. And I love that idea, because they're, what are they doing? They're following somebody and trying not to be seen. So switch cars constantly. I love that.
Yeah, I agree with, she was probably one of my favorite, she was my favorite church lady, if I could call the whole group of them that, just because she, I agree with you. She was like the, in a weird way, she was the least goofy, so I liked her the best. Mm-hmm. Like everyone else kind of had like a fatal flaw as to something as why they were not good at being the you know, like the tail on the cars, but they and I mean, I guess that's where the comedy came from, because, you know, the characters had some goofy thing that got in the way of them being good at it. Because you went with her, I'm going to switch mine up and go to, I am a big fan of the Strawberry Shortcake, if I could call them one of my favorite characters.
Hey, we're the monkeys. I mean, Strawberry Shortcake.
Which, you know, they got their Monday, pass a little love around, a little song. Tuesday, you could all jump in and sing. But
were
of course,
they before or after Strawberry Alarm Clock?
That would have been after Strawberry Alarm Clock, but before the Strawberry Shortcake cartoon show of the 80s.
Interesting.
Like the animated, the little, like girls with the you know, yep, baked good themed hats and whatnot. So yeah, they're right in the middle there. And it was goofy. That's like the whole, you know, Edward Herman, Reverend Hall, Hill brings them in to kind of jazz up the music in church. Make it something that all the kids will want to come to church because they got a cool rock band playing music in it, which totally has nothing to do with anything in the movie.
No.
Like, you could cut all the scenes, like cut them out of the whole thing, or like,
useless.
I just had to give them a shout out here. So we talked about some antics of, you know, both like, fun things that gags, that we've seen on Cleo Jackson's car windows. We talked about the Rafferty's being full of different gags. And of course, this movie, just like a lot of all of Disney's family live action movies, is full of gags. So let's get into talking about some gags that jumped out to you, some gags, physical comedies, you know, just hilarious situations that were, you know, what actually made you laugh, not, you know, if anything actually made you laugh, not just like a, hey, okay, but like a good, like, you know, that was funny kind of laugh.
I don't know if anything like made me like belly roll laugh, but I really got into the scene again with Mrs. Rafferty and the two other ladies at the sandwich shop and doing the tape recorder. And it's like the gag was already sprung before it happened, because it's, you know, that she's going to fumble it. I mean, that's just the character that she's already been set up for. And she's like, I got a tape recorder. And they're like, well, is it running? No. Well, why don't you start it so that we can be sure we get it? Oh, that's a good idea. And then she turns it on and hits the rewind button. And then she tries to cover it up. And then they make their bets. And then they're like, well, did you get it? Oh, let me check. It's like, really, you're gonna check right there where you know that there potentially is some illegal gambling and mob-related activities. And then she presses the play button, and it's the roll out the barrel.
See, this all goes back to, I think she is drunk through most of this movie, because this is like her tape she plays at home while she's drinking like a Miller Lite here.
And then they all
was popular in the late 70s.
And then they all join in, and that's when I laughed at that part.
I would agree. That was probably the fun for me. That was definitely like the whole scene of like the two, like, we look like the Bobbsey twins. I mean, between that and then like, yeah, the tape recorder, that whole scene was probably, at least if there was a scene I like laughed or thought was really, really funny as a whole, that was definitely it.
Now I need to rewatch it just from the perspective of Mrs. Rafferty is always drunk. Yeah,
she is. I'm telling you, watch it again.
I think one joke gag that deserves mention is the fact that to go gamble in the back room, you had to lose your pants.
Yeah,
yeah. Nice. Yeah,
I've got to deal with them. Everybody's got to give me their pants. Like, okay.
He'll press them while you wait.
Yeah,
50 cents.
Mm-hmm. And then you get the, so I'll extend your gag as my favorite gag, because he pays his 50 cents. He goes into the back room, but then he gets locked out of the back room and has to return to the church with no pants on. So it's like that one. I mean, maybe they were beating the dead horse until it was done with the pants jokes, but it was kind of funny that he had to go back to the church pantsless.
That was another funny part where, you know, he goes into the back room and it's not just a couple people. The whole place is just crowded with men smoking cigars and stuff, and they're all pantsless and they're silly boxer shorts making bets and waiting for the horses to race. And
well, see, you know what? That brings up an interesting point. I'm not bringing my clothes to a cleaner where their whole place smells like cigar smoke, because everything I'm going to get back is going to smell like cigar smoke.
Well, prove that they were there in the first place. All I saw were boxes.
All right. So we got some good gags. We got some good gags. Some maybe gags that make you groan, different things like that. I'm still going to make you guys, I was trying to make you guys in these first few questions, be nice to the movie. Don't worry. We could be mean to the movie later. But one last thing, I'm going to make you all say something nice about the movie right now. I want to know what each of you think, like if you could give some credit to this movie for something, what was something that worked really well in this movie?
For me, I think that, it's basically, this is an ensemble movie. It's not, you know, obviously like the Avengers or something like that, but doing an ensemble movie nowadays, you've got all these egos and people that are trying to be the star. And this movie didn't have that. Nobody was trying to show up everybody else. Nobody was trying to be like, you know, this is my movie. It was for an ensemble cast. You know, you didn't have anybody that, to up to today, you can say, wow, what a huge name. And that really worked for it. Nobody tried to, you know, make it a Tom Cruise movie or a Robert Downey Jr. movie. You know, they were all just there and did their part, and it worked much better that way.
I like that. So a ensemble really kind of, they kind of all worked together to make it what it was. No one really had that thing, except apparently for the Rafferty's. What about what about you, Mike? What worked well here?
You know, nice. My say answer. Something. I'll come last.
Say something. You're not allowed to say nothing.
I mean, I feel like the actors and actresses, they did the best they could with the source material. I mean,
I like that backhanded compliment. I'll take that backhanded compliment. I'll take it on behalf of the North Avenue Irregulars.
That's like the comment, to just do a little quick segue, to Tim Burton's Ed Wood, when they're talking about their last play performance and they get the reviews in and it's getting trashed, and they're like, no, you got to look at the positive here. Look, the costumes were very authentic. You know, I've been to plays where they don't even mention the costumes.
That's good. We're looking at the positive here.
So actors and actresses, I thought they did a fine job for what it was.
Nice. And Rob L, can't say nothing. What worked well?
This is what I will say worked well in the movie, or at least worked out well. I will say, with all of the car chases, I will say they were fairly like realistic. I mean, especially for late 70s, a Disney movie type of thing. I mean, the through the alleys, the turnarounds really quick and everything. I'll give them credit for that. It was pretty good. That's about it.
The cars do play a big part in it, which my thought on the cars, if I could go this route, is in the 70s, they had a big hit with the Love Bug, the Herbie movies, and kind of trying to lean into that. You know, people like cars. That was our last hit. Let's do some stuff with the cars in this one. I think that probably had some influence in the cars. But yeah, I think I agree with you there. They did a good a good car chase scene thing there. Now, I'll give it a compliment too, because I'm not going to exempt myself from that. I thought it did do a great job. Like all of those things, like you guys described, if we take all those together, and we look at it kind of like, you know what, like when you're like building a car or making a character in a video game, and it's like you could go for more speed, or you could go for more like speed, agility, whatever, all these different things, and they kind of have to balance out to be 100%. This one, it was like right down the middle. This movie is very right down the middle. And I think that kind of like what Jagoda said at the beginning, what Andrew said at the beginning, he said he was expecting middle of the road, and it hit middle of the road. And I think the movie is very good at hitting that middle of the road. It wasn't horrible. It wasn't great. It was just a good like pocket middle of the road family movie. I think it accomplished its goals in that sense. I'm going to say that it accomplished what it set out to do. Is what I'm going to say, which I guess maybe is also a backhanded compliment. Anyways, let's turn the tables on this movie and let's look at what doesn't work. So
now we're talking.
All right. So what doesn't work about this movie? Whoever wants to jump in first, whoever's most passionate about what doesn't work.
Rob, you're up.
I mean, I'll go back to something I said earlier. Like the whole thing, like you lose all the money and Delaney like is not held accountable at all. That just seems like bizarre. You think you would like talk to him. Like what's wrong with you, dude? But like, no, never talk to him. I mean, who knows? Maybe he's too busy drinking or something. I don't know what's going on in that household. But that was just like a weird part. Like I never understood it. Like, why they never went back to him. I mean, he was just became the comedy like foil through the entire movie, which was the best part in my opinion. But that was just definitely a hole initially in the movie I didn't understand.
Well, there's that, but I think that he also, in his weird way, is making his own atonement by going through and participating when the whole premise of the film and in real life, the Reverend was unable to kind of convince any of the male congregants to join in his quest to break up this illegal gambling ring. But Mr. Rafferty joins and he dresses as a lady. And I think he is participating because he knows what he did was wrong.
It's true.
I like it.
So it's a redemption arc for Delaney.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, for me, the thing about it, this movie, was that it was just basically mostly forgettable. I mean, yeah, there's a couple of gags, but then a year from now, probably the only thing I'll remember is the demo derby at the end. You know, the rest of it, I'll just kind of go, oh, yeah, it had something to do with a priest and some women, and I probably won't remember it.
Yeah, it really reminded me of some other films like or made for or TV in general. Like it felt like a long version of an Andy Griffith episode. Like it
and
felt
not
like
a good one.
No.
Like one of the later season ones.
Yeah.
One of the ones in color. Yeah.
Yeah. But it did. It felt like it felt long. For me, it felt really long. The car chases take up a lot of this movie. I even did some digging and I found an old Siskel and Ebert review that they did on their show of this this film. And I feel like they were probably as harsh as me and Rob.
Gotcha.
Basically, they accused Disney of kind of losing their way, which you kind of alluded to, Eric.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have not watched a whole lot of 1970s live action Disney films.
Well, get ready because I got more picks coming up. No, just kidding. No.
But based on their comments, it makes me curious because the way they spoke of this film made it sound like they had a very formulaic approach to making movies. And they specifically refer to, and I'm going to quote Siskel on it, "You know how Disney movies typically end with a big car chase at the end. Well, this one, that's the last third of the movie. And I agree with them. It's a very long chase scene and people speeding after each other. And then there's the demolition derby. And it felt really long. Like you could cut down maybe 15 minutes, 20 minutes of this movie. And maybe I would have enjoyed it more if it were shorter.
Like a 1 hour TV special.
Mm-hmm. 45 yeah. minutes.
Well, it's 45 minutes with commercials to be a 1 hour TV special.
That's true. Yeah. And I mean, I agree totally with that, Mike. Cause I did, I kind of just zoned out during that, all that car chasing. I'm like, all right, I get it. This one has to turn and turn around and go down that alley and da 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 da. And I mean, to me too, I know we're talking about Delaney being funny and all, but the opening too, I thought went on too long.
Yeah.
The gag with the ladder. I'm like, I thought, you know, this is, yeah, I get it. It's supposed to be funny, get the family laughing, whatever, but it's just
way too long.
It took forever.
Way yeah. too long.
No, I agree completely because I usually take notes when I'm watching the movie and you know, I had started taking notes and, you know, I have to bring it up because it's another moment that made me chuckle a little. The Reverend has arrived to his new church with his two children. And the little boy opens the door just a crack and peeks his head in and just says, "God, are you home?"
And, I'm not gonna lie, I laughed at that too.
I was like, what? And then, you know, you think that all these have got to be pretty good kids, you know, pretty respectful kids. And then he goes up the ladder and he sees the rope and he just pulls it and it causes Rafferty to fall. He's outside painting the bell tower for whatever reason. And he holds on to the bell rope and it's ringing the bell more and he's holding on for dear life. And now the whole town has assembled in front of the church and they're like, oh, well, how are we going to get him down? Let's get a ladder. Oh, no, it doesn't reach. We got to bring the ladder up to him. Let's go up God. To the top of the bell tower and we'll hand the ladder down. And oh, we'll have like a little parachute to catch him in. And oh, no, he slid the other way. And now he's on the other side of the church.
And then he's defying the laws of gravity and like hovering in the air on top of the ladder.
And so at this point, I would say the movie's been running for probably about 5 or 6 minutes with this scene. And I just wrote down in my notes, what the heck is this movie?
And on top of that, those two kids that you mentioned, that's their entire point for being in the movie is just to pull that rope. Yeah. They don't do anything else. That's it.
Well, they do have a father-daughter discussion later on, but it's not a very
forgetful. Don't even yeah. remember it.
Well, just give it up is basically what the daughter is relaying. Kind of the same thing that Anne had been telling the Reverend to just give up trying to end these mobsters, you know?
I'm glad you guys brought up the kids because that's precisely what I think doesn't work about this movie. There's kids in this movie. But they're not, they're just kind of like props. The yeah. kids in this movie are essentially props. There's animals in this movie, and they're essentially props. And when you think about like the formula of, I'm going to hold Mary Poppins as like the formula of the pristine Disney family movie, because it's the most award-winning one. It's the most memorable. It's got, you know, you laughed, you cried, you got songs, there's animated stuff in it. It's got everything. You've got kids in this movie, but the kids aren't in this movie. So like, it's almost like the plot is the grown-ups doing stuff. So the kids might lose interest because there's not that like equality of the kids being part of it. Like, I mean, I guess it's all like, you know, the grownups are being goofy. The kids can laugh at the grownups, but like the kids don't have a, like an avatar in the movie. They don't have someone in the movie to be like representing them on screen enough to hold the interest of that, of, you know, that portion of your family watching the movie. And I think the grown-ups watching the movie, the parents watching with their kids, are would probably enjoy more of a realistic drama version of what actually happened than this car chase goofiness that we end up getting. So I think that's kind of the case of Disney getting things watered down over time from their family movie formula, because Disney does follow a formula a lot in the 70s, because they, you know, they're trying to get that family movie gold that they achieved in the 60s, but they don't have that like clear vision from Walt. So I think that kind of shows how far it's gotten watered down since like the really great stuff in the mid 60s. So that I'm going to jump to this question here that I want to ask you guys about. What was there anything about this movie that screamed Disney to you, or anything that was like, I don't even know why this has Disney's name on it? Like one or the other end of the spectrum that was very Disney, wasn't Disney at all.
To me, the way that they handled the car crashes at the end of the movie felt very Disney, because yeah, there's all these cars flying all over the place that, and there could be huge accidents, but no one gets hurt. Even though this was before seatbelts were required in cars and before they had airbags in cars.
Definitely.
So that's very Disney to me, that could have everybody just walk away. Oh yeah. Okay. I'm fine. And you know, oh yeah, he's fine. And blah, blah, blah. And no consequence really.
Yeah. I agree with that. And also the fact that they were able to take, you know, a fairly serious topic, and they just cleaned it out and was like, all right, no one gets hurt. No one dies. No blood. We'll have some broken fingernails. But overall, like no swearing. It was very family friendly, kind of like a Swiss Family Robinson kind of niceness, really.
But not as good as the Swiss Family Robinson.
No.
I would agree with that. I mean, I didn't think about that, but that's true, because like no one got hurt, no one got killed per se. I mean, it had the explosion of the church, but no, I mean, one was in it. I mean, it was essentially like a mob infiltration, mob takedown type of movie, but nobody got whacked. I mean, what kind of movie is that for a mob movie, right? Somebody's ultimately got to pay the piper, or like is going to take it down by the mob. But yeah, I mean, so I guess that's kind of like a Disney-esque kind of to it, where you said nobody gets hurt.
I was just going to say that church explosion really caught me off guard. I was not expecting it.
It's very incongruous with the rest of the movie.
Yes.
Yeah.
I will say the only other thing that if there was not any of the intro that said that it was a Disney movie, you could have fooled me. I would have just thought it was a very poorly made family movie, and that was about it. But I mean, some of the things we're talking about now, kind of, yeah, I could buy that in thinking it's a Disney movie, but you could have fooled me if it didn't have it all bannered out in the beginning and advertised and such. I just think it didn't have some of those things. Like, no kids, like you said earlier, there's not a lot of kids involved as like the main characters or surrounding the kids, which is so much of a kind of the Disney movies that at least I grew up on and I still like to this day. So, if I didn't know, you could have fooled me.
The one thing that to me, though, that kind of made me think, this is probably a Disney movie without them saying it, was that animated sequence at the beginning that we were talking about, and specifically because it made me think of Honey, I Shrunk the Kids and movies like that from when I was a kid. But other than that, yeah, I would say Rob's right. There's a lot of parts where you kind of forget that it's a Disney movie just because it is so like, meh. Yeah.
No, I think too, like us being, the age that we are, being, you know, like mid to late, I guess we gotta say late 30s at this point. We grew up at a time when Disney was like on top of its game. And I know, like, as a kid, I was aware of movies from like, well, the animated movies, of course, from Disney, but like, I was aware of the live action movies from the 60s. somewhat in the 50s too. And I was aware of live action movies definitely from the 90s because, you know, being a young kid in the 90s. But there was kind of a big gap in that like 70s area. Like, I mean, I guess you could say 80s and 90s was what I knew. But in the 70s, I don't know that I knew anything from the 70s that was Disney. If we had grown up at a different time, this might feel way Disney to us. If we grew up in the 70s in our formative years and saw a bunch of Disney movies like this. But no, definitely, I feel like this has gotten kind of pushed away to the side. All right. So having seen this movie, now that we've all seen it, I do want to ask this. So let's go this way. So Disney Plus has been out for like 2 years, almost now, 3 years, almost now, over 2 years. And the North Avenue Regulars has not yet shown up on Disney Plus. Disney Plus has added older movies, newer movies, movies from the 70s, weird stuff like from around the same time. But the North Avenue Regulars has never shown up from release date till the end. Now, Disney has purposely kept some movies off. For instance, Song of the South was kept off because it should not be shown anywhere. I'm just going to go ahead and say it. It shouldn't be shown anywhere, so they're not going to put it on there. Some people are still like holding out hope that they might put it out there because they did start adding little disclaimers to the beginning of some things that say, you know, like this has outdated references or tobacco use or whatever. But some things are purposely not on Disney Plus. I want to know, do you guys think North Avenue Irregulars is not on Disney Plus for a reason? And if so, why is it not on Disney Plus yet? It would have made it a whole lot easier for us to watch this if it was on Disney Plus.
I mean, I don't think that there's anything sinister in them keeping it off. I think it's more the fact that how do you promote it? You say it's a movie with Cloris Leachman. I mean, there's not really a big following that they can say, hey, look what we've added to Disney Plus and get a lot of viewers. It's just a movie that you go, okay, it's kind of mediocre. And I recognize a couple of names, but nobody's really clamoring for a Skipper movie.
Where he's only in about like, what, 5 minutes?
Yeah. If that.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, having watched the movie, to me, like you guys have been saying, it's kind of just a mediocre film. I don't know why it wouldn't be on Disney Plus. There's not really anything culturally inappropriate that I could see, other than, you know, depicting Irish people as drunks.
Which is never blatantly stated.
No. Well, he is like he fell off. Mr. Rafferty fell off the bell tower and they saved him and he's covered in paint and he's like touching the church furniture with his paint hands. And he's asking if they have any sacramental wine. And it's like,
that's true.
Come on. That's a cheap joke. But there's like nothing blatantly offensive and it's not like a god awful movie. Yeah.
Nice pun there with the Presbyterian church thing going on.
I mean, my biggest question about this whole film is why do they film it this way? Why do they decide to turn it into a comedy? I'm really interested about the Reverend's book. I might have to try to locate it because the true story behind it sounds very interesting.
Definitely. It could be a mob movie. I mean, somebody get whacked. I mean, it kind of to fit that mold of that. I'd watch that movie. This one,
Yeah. Or you could do something maybe a little bit, I don't know, a little bit better. It made me think of movies like The Burbs and stuff. Just kind of like the paranoia of like, oh, what's going on there, and really getting more of the like the espionage and really trying to pin things down rather than car chase scenes. And I thought one of the major details of the true story is the Reverend did go out and ask the men, and they all were like, nah, we're not getting involved with the mob. And then he basically finds out how much power and control the mob had in their community. And he kind of started asking for the women's help, and they were more than willing to be supportive and help, you know, crack up this crime ring. And then I feel like the movie's like, hey, a bunch of women are going to help break up the mob. Isn't that hilarious? Let's have them be bad drivers and be worried right. about their nails. And it's like, what?
I mean, that might be part of it, too. Is I mean, it is very male chauvinistic. I mean, the yeah. FBI guys call them dames. You could probably have a shot every time they said dames, you'd probably be loaded by half the movie.
For sure.
So, I mean, maybe that's part of it. I mean, on top of like the Irish drunkard kind of stereotypes that you mentioned, Mike, and maybe it's just kind of, it's not like a silver bullet that kind of knocks this movie out. It's like all of the different things throughout. It's kind of like, all right, it's a little too much. We're not going to put it on there.
I mean, another option is maybe everyone at Disney has forgotten about it. Because as you guys have said, it's forgettable.
Now, I'll ask a question.
Yeah.
Do you think it ever will go on Disney Plus?
The completist in me hopes so.
Yeah, I have a feeling that with Disney, they're going to wait for a rainy day. They're going to wait for subscribers to not plateau, but to start dropping off, kind of like what we're seeing with what's going on with Netflix.
Yeah.
And then magically, Disney's going to be like, welcome to our whole catalog. All our movies, except for the really, really bad ones, are now available for streaming.
So you're saying the North Avenue Irregulars is the umbrella on Disney's rainy day?
Yeah, it's
one of them.
It's when they have to shift to quantity, not quality.
I gotcha. I'm with you.
You know, I think I agree with you there, Mike. It's because let's go around and we could if you want to give your final assessment on whether you liked it or not. Go for it. I'm gonna jump in and I'll start with mine as the guy who picked it and the Disney fan. I think I enjoy watching it? Yes. I had fun watching it. My expectations were checked, similar to Andrew. It wasn't the best I've seen. Would I watch it again? Maybe. I wouldn't necessarily choose to. Like when it shows up on Disney Plus, if it does that rainy day, I'm not going to rush to start it again. There are movies from this time period that I liked a whole lot better. But I don't think it was bad. I liked it enough. That's my final, like, you know, that's my, I liked it enough, I think, is where I landed on it. What about you guys?
I'll go along with that. I liked it enough too. I feel like I probably won't watch it again, but it's a movie that maybe if it was on TV and I just had it on in the background, like it wouldn't bother me. It's not a movie where you have to be fully invested trying to figure out what's going on. It's pretty straightforward. One thing I will say is that the name of it to me was kind of an odd choice. I know because of the book that they wanted to stick to that, but whoever was in charge of the promoting it in the UK, I thought did a better job, because in the UK it was Hills Angels. And I thought that was just a great name.
Good pun. Good pun. Yeah, there.
A great way to go. And I almost wonder if maybe a more direct title like that would have gained more of a lasting audience. And that's my take on it.
Yeah, and I think for me, I'm not going to watch it again. But I am still, like I said, very much interested in the true story behind it.
Absolutely.
If someone were to come out with a documentary or even a film loosely based on it, I probably would watch it. I think it's a very interesting story. I mean, you know, this is the 60s and they're fighting New York mobsters. And it's a reverend and some women from his parish. And it like, that's fascinating. Let's not make it this slapstick goofy comedy.
I agree with you, Mike. Get Martin Scorsese on the horn right now.
What's Robert De Niro? What's Robert De Niro doing right now?
Just get him on the horn, make it happen. But here's the way. I mean, I think my feelings for the movie are pretty apparent. So I'll say it this way: I like to watch movies over and over and over again. Or if a movie comes on TV and I've seen it before, I'll leave it on if I remotely like it. If this came on, I'd change the channel.
But the batteries in your remote are dead.
Oh, no.
And unplug the TV.
You guys kind of clamoring for a more true-to-life drama, maybe representation of this movie, I think is very valid. And I honestly, maybe I'm projecting too much on Ron Miller, who later kind of becomes the scapegoat when the Disney company almost falls apart in the 80s. I'm coming around to him as a Disney fan. And I think because he goes on later in the early 80s to create Touchstone Pictures, like a lot of people might think it was Michael Eisner who did that. I mean, Michael Eisner rockets that up here. I'm getting Disney inside baseball. Sorry. But Ron Miller wanted to create more grown up, you know, movies, and he starts experimenting right around this time in the 80s. He tries to make like a teenage movie with this Midnight Madness. I'll have to put that on my list at some point. He starts making the Touchstone imprint. He's the one who like greenlights Splash with Tom Hanks is that Daryl Hannah? And he starts moving that way. And I wonder if this is kind of like part of that experiment, and because he wasn't equipped yet to push into the world of like serious movies, he had to work within the realm of Disney family movies, and that's why it doesn't hit any of those, you know, serious crime movie for grown-ups or slapstick kids movie family movie kind of thing. I think it kind of has some growing pains there. But no, yeah, definitely a updated version, but the true story reflected better. I think I'd like that too.
So that was North Avenue Irregulars. Let us know what you thought of the movie. Maybe it was one of your favorites. Maybe you have fond childhood memories. And maybe we're looking at this all wrong. Let us know what you think of it. But as for what's coming up next, you know, we have a lot more ideas of shows about various music and movies that, you know, again, we think are overlooked or, you know, we should revisit. For the summer, I think we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to actually be reaching out to our wives, get some input on something that they think we should be taking a deeper look into. And for starters, I'm going to pass it over to Mr. Andrew Jagoda.
Yes. So my wife, Sarah, has decided that we should watch the movie Batteries Not Included, which is a 1987 sci-fi comedy movie. I don't know too many names off of it that people might know. Jessica Tandy is one of the stars. But yeah, we should have a good time watching that and getting some opinions from Sarah on the movie too. And we'll see how that goes next month. So be sure to listen to us and be sure ahead of time to look for a copy. You can rent it on the usual streaming services or, of course, check your local library, and should be a fun little trek into my wife's preferences here.
Visit us online at rarecutsmediasociety.com. There you can find old episodes, subscribe, or connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Thanks for listening.
Where's Goober?
Goober. Goober would be the main character.
Because the Gomer episodes were good. Goober, hot garbage.
Don't get me started on that Aunt B. So.
Coming next month on Rare Cuts Media Society, Gomer versus Goober.